morning, everyone. My name's Jane, and I'm an alcoholic. I cannot tell you how wonderful it is to be here. I first want to, of course, take care of the niceties and thank the committee for all your hard work. Oh, man, has it paid off. This has been so much fun. And I also want to thank Robbie for coming to pick me up at the airport and Deb for making that phone call about a year ago. And while I'm from Tallahassee, I don't know if you've noticed from my accent, I am a Jersey girl. Woo! You can take the girl out of Jersey, but you can't take the Jersey out of the girl. But anyway, you guys have made me so proud of my home state. What a fun bunch. I mean, the last night's dance was awesome. The karaoke was a lot of fun. The speakers this weekend have been awesome. I want to thank Mary Claire for her talk on Friday night. And just to let you guys know, the first half of my talk is almost exactly the same as hers. And we had a really weird, you know, 6 degree of separation connection because her mother worked with my father, and when she mentioned that she drank 4 years straight at the Pinewood, that was my college bar. I also drank 4 years straight at the Pinewood. And I also want to thank Michelle and Paul C. And, oh, man, did Ralph knock your socks off last night or what? Ralph. So anyway, it really just has been a great convention. It's especially special for me, too, because my mom and my dad and my sister are here. They live up in North Jersey. I grew up in Caldwell. And they hear that I go on all these things, and they know I do all this stuff. And this is their first time coming to see what it's all about. And what a first-time experience this has been for them. You guys have blown their mind. Can you stand up, Mom, Dad, Tara? Yeah! Woo! That makes me feel so much better because they didn't get to stand up for the countdown last night. But anyway, my home group, again, is a central group in Tallahassee, Florida, and by the grace of God, by wonderful sponsorship, and the love of my family and my friends, I've been sober since September 24th, 1996. And that is truly a miracle. I love that the name of this, or the whole theme of this, is there will be peace. You know, in my opinion, peace begins with a smile, and this room is just filled with peace right now. All the wonderful smiles that you get from strangers, I mean, the hugs that I've received from strangers, it just blows my mind. I feel beauty all around me in this room. When I'm in a crowd this big, I can't help but to mention grace, God's grace, and how cool it is. You know, grace has nothing to do with what we've done. You know, grace is just there for the giving. It doesn't have anything to do with what we've done or what we haven't done. And that's why I love it, and I think that's why they have that song, Amazing Grace. You know, it's the inner realization that we're already one with God. You know, there's nothing that we can do to have that taken away from us. We always have grace. We'll always have grace. I mean, what kind of a sweet assurance is that? It always brings me peace. And the other thing that I also can't help but mention when I'm in a group of this size is miracles. You know, I'm certainly a miracle. I shouldn't be standing before you right now. I should be dead. And I know that probably every single person in this room should also be dead. And it's a miracle that we all made it through. And wow, what power is that, knowing that God left us here for a reason. And, you know, maybe one of the reasons was being here at this convention to show love to each other. Maybe there were quite a few newcomers, people who had, you know, even less than a year last night during the countdown. That's the reason why we're here. So, you know, the other miracle that I always am blown away by is the fact that every day, somewhere in this world, one alcoholic shares their story with another. And, you know, we all have stories. We all have different stories. We all, you know, God speaks to us all in different ways, but expects us to share our story. And that's actually why I'm here before you tonight. I'm here to tell you what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like now. But before I do that, I'm kind of nervous. And, you know, when I talk to my sponsor, he's like, "Don't worry, Jane, you're supposed to be nervous because that really means that you're humble enough to allow God to work through you." Because honestly, I ask God to sort of empty myself and pray that the Holy Spirit will put the words in my mouth that somebody in this group needs to hear. So I was wondering if you wouldn't mind just centering with me and saying the third step prayer with me right now. So it always brings me peace, and I thought maybe if you wanted to, you could close your eyes and join me in saying it. God, I offer myself to thee to build with me and to do with me what as thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self, that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. May I do thy will always. God, take my will in my life. Guide me in my recovery, and please put the words in my mouth today that somebody in this audience needs to hear. Okay, well, as we all know too, sometimes our dark past is our greatest gift, the greatest possession we have. And while I wish I had like sort of a comedy routine up here, my story is one that's of a tragic nature, but it has a really happy ending. But I figured I'd start at the beginning, and my story starts on November 20th, 1962. I was born in Caldwell, New Jersey, to the most wonderful parents that a kid could have asked for. I'm the second oldest. I have an older brother and two younger brothers and a younger sister, so there are five of us. And, you know, they say in alcohol, well, they say every alcoholic comes from a family who didn't love them enough or a family who loved them too much. And I come from a family who loved me very, very, very much. You know, my mom was a stay-at-home mom. She did everything for her children and, you know, just waited on my dad hand and foot and was very happy doing so. That's what makes her happy, is loving her family, and her family is everything to her. She's very strong, though, and she doesn't put up with any nonsense, but my dad was definitely the one that was the disciplinarian, and my dad's a great guy, great sense of humor. I'm actually really proud of my dad. I was sharing at my banquet table last night. He's a track coach, and he was actually one of the first milers to be favored to break the 4-minute mile. So that gives you a sense of how disciplined and, you know, hardworking my dad is, and how when he sets a goal, he goes for it. And we were raised in a house that was, you know, we had a really healthy respect for my dad. We did not mess with dad. It was almost like having a military dad in a lot of ways, you know. But he was also very loving and funny and a real family man. And we were really fortunate growing up because he coached at a college, so he had the summers off. So we would take some great family vacations. They always had some, like, history behind them. You know, we had to go, like, I remember one time we went down to Jekyll Island, Georgia, and, you know, all seven of us in an unair-conditioned Pontiac Le Mans. And, you know, we just took all those kind of really fun vacations. So my memories of childhood are just great, magical. I mean, couldn't have been better. Could not have been better. When I can honestly say that probably before I got out of diapers, I knew how to say the Hail Mary, the Our Father, and the Act of Contrition. I come from a really Irish Catholic family. The blood that courses through these veins is 100% Irish, and I happen to think that that automatically predisposes me to the disease of alcoholism. So anyway, but in my immediate family, mom and dad didn't drink, but, you know, aunts, uncles, cousins, all over the place. It's all over my family tree. So anyway, you know, I was a really good girl, very gregarious, talkative, smart. Mom was always telling me how wonderful and how beautiful I was. I don't have any idea where these feelings of low self-esteem came from. And it was my adolescence when they started to really kick in. I always felt like, you know, I wasn't pretty enough. I knew I was smart, but I kind of started to get cunning and maneuvering with my smartness, you know. I also had wonderful experiences like Mary Claire with the nuns and the priests, went to Catholic schools, Catholic elementary school. You know, I have really nothing but fond memories of those experiences. When I went to an all-girl Catholic high school, Mount St. Dominic Academy for Girls, in Caldwell, New Jersey, and some of you might know one of my famous friends in high school was Whitney Houston, and hopefully Whitney's getting the help that she needs, because she also has a tragic story. Kind of reminds me of Judy Garland, actually. But anyway, it was a small class, 81 girls in the class of 81. So it was a really tight group, and I was just the all-American girl when I was in high school. I didn't drink. I didn't smoke pot. I was on the student council. I was on the track team, of course. I was in the choir. I was in the drama club. My friends that were doing bad stuff would keep it away from me because they, you know, thought that I would, like, give them a pep talk about it. I mean, I was definitely Miss Pris. But that's sort of when my rebellion started. You know, my rebellion is a big part of my story. But anyway, I remember the first time that I drank. I was 14. I said I didn't drink in high school, but I did have one isolated experience. I was 14 years old, and I went to the movies with my cousin. And I know I'm dating myself, but it was the original Star Wars. And I remember, you know, if you guys remember, that was like way cool and way before its time. And my cousin had two of her girlfriends, and they bought a big bottle of rum, and we got Cokes. And she just started dumping tons of rum into her little 14-year-old cousin's glass and thought it was really funny as I was sitting there going, woo, woo, wow, cool, you know. And I love that was, you know, when it happened, the lasers, Battlestar Galactica's flying all over the place. But symbolically, what it did was it took me into another world. I entered a whole other plane, and I loved it. I thought it was the coolest thing until, you know, her friend who had just bought a brand new car, they were driving me home, and I puked all over the back seat of the car. So, and I felt terrible, and I was like, man, that sucked, but it really, you know, it was definitely worth it. Like, that feeling was like, woo, you know? But anyway, I didn't go there again until I went to college. And I went to Manhattan College in New York City, and it was pretty much the case of, like, the sheltered girl living in a glass house, going into the big city, and going buck wild. And it was cool because all the girls that I was going to school with were raised the same way that I was raised. It was predominantly Irish, Italian. Most of us went to private Catholic schools, and I couldn't believe how much they were partying. So I was like, oh, well, they were raised the same way I was. You know, I'm not going to feel guilty about it. I'm going to party just like they're partying. And freshman semester, I put on from, you know, just till Christmas time, the start of school till Christmas, 25 pounds. And I'll tell you, it was not the food. It was definitely beer. And I was one of those that was, you know, out partying every night. I mean, I was a party girl. And where we... where Manhattan College is located, it's the last subway stop on the one train, so it's like 242nd Street and Broadway. So I had access to New York City 24/7, and let me tell you, I tore that city up. Now remember, this was the 80s, okay? Just to save you, if you're wondering how old I am, I'm 48. So it was the 80s, and it was a crazy time, folks. Those of you who lived and partied in New York City know exactly what I'm talking about. And and I tore that city up for, you know, a good 3 years. I would be lying and leaving something vague out if I didn't tell you that outside issues are involved in my story. The outside issues that I'm talking about are of the smoke time type and the snort type. But I do feel like I had to let you know that they are a part of my story, even though I completely believe in the singleness of this program. But again, my definition of alcoholism is it's a disease of the brain that translates into abnormal behaviors. So we all know those abnormal behaviors. Some of us write checks, bad checks. Some of us have indiscriminate sexual encounters. Some of us, wake up naked on people's front lawns, not knowing how we got there. Some people have no idea where they left their car parked that night. Some people get DUIs, you know. And while most of those things happen to me, some people also turn to drugs and hit that ATM machine and the party's on. So that's the way I like to explain my outside issues, and that's the way I like to explain they are a part of my story. But beyond the shadow of a doubt, the love of my life was alcohol. I didn't do any of that stuff without first drinking and drinking throughout it, too. So I just wanted to let you know that that they were a big part of my story. And I think that goes without saying when you were partying in New York City in the 80s. I mean, I was doing, you know, the Studio 54, the Tunnel, the Peppermint Lounge, the Limelight, all those clubs. I mean, all the time. It was everything all the time. So anyway, junior year, I was really getting tired, and so I got accepted to go to school in France. And so I thought, okay, here's my first geographical change. I'm going to go to France. I'm going to be a good student. I'm going to actually study. And then after France, the plan was to backpack through Europe. So thank God, I moved in with a French divorcee and her 11-year-old son, and he had a 19-year-old nanny like myself, Myriam. She was a French student. And what happened? The little city that we lived up, Nantes, we tore that city up every night. I mean, we were out partying. Everywhere I went, I swear, I met party people. Isn't that crazy about us? I mean, so anyway, we ended up just having a great time. I learned how to speak French pretty well, I think. but anyway, it was a pass-fail system, thank God, because I passed by the skin of my teeth. I knew my parents wouldn't have been happy if I came back with a fail after, you know, all that money they spent. But then the summertime, my dad flew over, and my little sister flew over, and he wanted to take us on a trip, so we went through Ireland together. It was really nice father-daughter vacation. It was one of the best vacations of my life. But he was shocked when he saw me, because I went over I started backpacking with $300. I spent the first 150 of it in Amsterdam loading up for my trip, and then the last 150 getting my hair done in London. And it was like hot pink. How about it, Dad? Hot pink, white shoots coming out the front and like shaved up one side. Oh, yeah. I was happening. So, anyway. But I still had a great time. And again, I had no money. And somehow I always met people that were drinking, that would feed me, that would, you know, let me sleep on their couch. I mean, it was just a great trip. And I never, ever got into any trouble. That is another miracle. I never got, nobody even ever tried to try anything funny with me. I have a one hell of a guardian angel that works overtime, let me tell you, because I think of some of the things I did and the situations I put myself into, but thank God nothing ever happened. Okay, so fast forward, go back to New York. finished my last year of college thinking, okay, I'm going back to New York. This time, I'm not going to drink, and I'm going to be good, and I'm going to stay away from the people that, well, you know, whatever. You know what happened. You go right, fall right back into the same scheme. I graduated from college, lucked out, got a job teaching high school. Right off the bat, I taught high school English and French. And I don't know how I did it. I lived in Hoboken. I didn't want to get too far away from New York City, but Hoboken had a party scene of its own going on. And I have no idea how I did the next 3 years teaching. I mean, because I have a crazy work ethic that I get from my folks, that no matter what, you show up for work. So I would be driving home at like 6 a.m., hop in a freezing cold shower, put my clothes on, and get my butt to work. I mean, honestly, I don't know how I did that. But then things started to get caught up. You know, things started to catch up with me. I started getting in all sorts of trouble. But I got away with so much because I was bubbly and cute and, you know, pretty slick with, my words. And I got out of a lot of things. So, you know, I was like this protected little princess that I thought was above all the harsh realities of life. So anyway, finally, I started to do some things at that point. Ralph talked about the pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization. All the things that I said that I would never do, I started to cross those lines. All my morals and my values, I started to cross those lines. I when I was teaching high school, I dated a married guy for 2 years. Yeah, what was I thinking? That was so not me. Big line crossing. And other things. You know what I'm talking about. I don't have to get specific. My dad's here. Unless there's an EMT with a defibrillator back there, I better like fast forward through that part. Girls, you know what I'm talking about. Looking for love in all the wrong places. So, anyway. Okay, so, next up was my first DUI. And I got my first DUI, and I was like, oh, well, you know. After the thousands of times that I drove drunk and the thousands of times that I, even in New York City, I would forget where I parked my car. I'd have to, like, go to the pound a couple days later and find out where my car was. Or when I was living in Hoboken, I remember getting so sick of driving around and around and around for parking spaces. I used to just be like, you know what, the hell with it, and pull up on the sidewalk in front of a fire hydrant and park. I mean, it was just crazy. So anyway, I had a friend of mine who lived down in the Florida Keys, and he said, why don't you come down here and waitress? You know, you could ride your bike everywhere. So I thought to myself, wow, great idea. I'm going to go down to the Florida Keys and try and stop partying. Right. So anyway, I did move down to the Florida Keys, and needless to say, things just got really, really bad. You know, I am so embarrassed because I'm going to have to back up here for a minute. When I was 25, before I moved to the Florida Keys, because this is a pretty big portion of my life, I had had it with Japan. I mean, I had had it with New York, and I moved to Japan. How could I forget that? So I was 25, and I was ready for another geographical change, and I was like, wow, where can I go where there's really not a lot of drinking and no drugs? And somebody said, go to Japan. So, I mean, this friend of mine had just said, hey, I have a friend who's recruiting for teaching companies in Japan. He's going to be in New York next week. Do you want me to set up an interview for you? And I was like, I would love that. So I went on the interview. It was a guy from England who interviewed me. We went out and got loaded 3 nights in a row. And he's like, you got the job. So 3 weeks later, I was on a plane to Japan. I didn't know how to say anything except for domo arigato, Mr. Roboto. That was about it. So anyway, but I went. And And I had a great time. But who was I kidding when I thought I was going to cut back on my drinking in Japan? Those men can drink. And the nature of my job was I taught in for Time Life Educational Services. So I taught all the Japanese businessmen an intensive English course. But they were being transferred overseas right after they took my course. So they had to speak English all week long, and I had to eat breakfast, lunch, dinner with them, and go out drinking with them every night. And sometimes these were like I worked at Toyota, I worked at Honda, I worked at Mitsubishi, I worked at the big companies, and my job was really kind of important. but you know, there was a lot of really good cultural exchanges during the drinking episodes, so I rationalized it all away, and we ended up having a great time. And those were three of the greatest years of my life. But that's when I started knowing I had a problem. That's when my drinking, it had been out of control for a while, but that's the point where I was like, oh my God, I think, you know, something's wrong here. I'm drinking every day. When I'm not drinking, I'm waking up in the morning and I'm a little shaky. By this time, my family had really started to alienate me, and actually moving to Japan was one of those moves like, I'll move to Japan and they'll see how cool I am and they'll miss me and they'll love me, and when I come back, everything's going to be great again. No, it wasn't like that. You know, my family just started to be, you know, I would worry them whenever I was around, whenever there was a family wedding or a family function or whatever. I, you know, would make a total fool of myself. I really screwed up, and I really started pushing my family away. And then I was like, oh, well, I've got my drinking family and here in Japan, and we're having a great time. But my friend Keta, who lives in England, she actually cut me a journal entry of hers out and sent it to me not too long ago. And it's funny, but it's actually also pretty sad. The journal entry said, my friend Jane has decided to cut back on her drinking. That means she didn't drink for lunch on Thursday. So anyway, the Japan thing really started getting out of control. So after 3 years, I was like, you know what? I better go home. You know, I'm almost 30 years old now, not attracted to Japanese men per se. I got to go home and, you know, meet a guy and get married and have kids and settle down. I'm pretty sure I've sowed all my wild oats, but, you know, and that was it, really. That's a big part of my story. I just wanted to sow my wild oats. I always thought I would settle down and, you know, again, have the Cinderella dream and, you know, find my Prince Charming and all that kind of stuff, but it didn't happen. So, anyway, I did move down to the Florida Keys. Sorry, I forgot about that Japan episode. Let's fast forward to the Florida Keys, and that's where it got really dark. That's where it got really dark. You know, the alcohol, the outside issues, it was pathetic. I got down to 115 pounds. I was emaciated. I wasn't eating much. And I was just miserable. And, it was a dark period in my life. And I had a moment of clarity when I was down there, and I called one of my cousins up in Fort Lauderdale, and I was like, Betty, I'm in trouble. I've got some money. Can I come up there? And, you know, and I did get some money from that was owed me. So I got the chunk of money, and rather than spend it on what I was spending it on, at that moment of clarity said, I better get out of here or I'm going to die. So I went up and stayed with my cousin, got it together, met a great guy. His name was Max. He was living in Austria at the time. And, you know, it was pretty cool because he was, you know, he knew Europe really well. He was well-traveled, well-educated, and a lot of fun. And we had a long-distance relationship, but he would come in like once a month. And he loved to party. So our first party weekend together, well, no, it wasn't our first party weekend together, but this one particular weekend, he wanted to go down. He was into like an ex-adventure tour packages, like sports things. So he wanted to go down and see what kind of water sports and stuff were available down in the Florida Keys. So I was like, oh, well, I have some friends down there. Let's go check it out. So we proceeded to go down to the Keys. First tiki bar that we hit, boom, we went in and had a bunch of drinks, and we proceeded down, you know, the key to Marathon, which was our final destination. And so we drank all that night, you know, we probably put in a good like 8 hours of drinking that day. We were dancing, having fun, went back, took a nap, and then got up again because a friend of mine's band was playing down the road. So after the band was playing, we decided to take a drive to the old 7 Mile Bridge, and they had just blown that bridge up for the movie True Lies with Arnold Schwarzenegger. And so, but the only sign that was up there was a sign that said authorized vehicles only. So we were like, oh, well, vehicles, let's go down it, you know, let's check it out. And earlier that evening, we had gone to the bridge to watch the sunset, so we thought we would go and watch the sunrise this time. So we're proceeding down that bridge road. This is the part that I hate. And I went barreling into a cement blockade. And it was just this flash of lightning of pain. And I was like, oh my God, where did that come from? Who put that big cement block barrier there? And I was looking for a reassuring word from Max, but he was just still. He looked like he hit his head. And then I put my hand down to my ankle, and when I lifted my hand up, it was covered in blood. And I could feel the bones in my ankles. And I was like, oh my God, get me out of here. What's happening? Oh my God. You know, the car, the whole front was just accordioned in. I couldn't move. And it didn't take me too long to realize that Max wasn't breathing. And that he was dead. I can't tell you what went through my mind. I mean, I wanted to die too. Like, how was I gonna live with this? But the bigger part of me was like, oh my God, I can't do this to my sister. I can't do this to my parents. I can't do this to my brothers. Breathe, breathe, breathe. So I just kept breathing, and believe me, every breath was a conscious effort. It seemed like an eternity before I saw those blue lights. And actually, for those of you who are still, you know, kind of on the fence about spiritual things, the police officer said that he had driven right past the old 7 Mile Bridge, and he said something told him to stop, and he literally backed his police car up and went down, and he said he wasn't even surprised to see the scene that he saw there. And that police officer was so nice. I remember him patting my hair and just telling me, just stay calm, everything's going to be all right. You know, and I thought he was just going to look at me like, you piece of crap, drunk driver, look at what you did, look at the guy next to you, you know. But he wasn't. He was so loving. Anyway, I saw him at a subsequent hearing, and he told me that story, and he just said that it changed his life, because it was like this power greater than himself that turned him around and brought him down there. And without that happening, I definitely would be dead, because I was on my last breaths. So I got heliported to Jackson Memorial, I'm going to try and just go through this part really fast because it really sucks. But, I mean, my dad got on they got the call saying they didn't know if I was going to make it through the night because my brain was swelling. Just to tell you about my injuries, too, my neck was broken at C1, C2, which is the same fracture that Christopher Reeve sustained. So a third of the people who sustain that fracture die instantly. A third of them are paralyzed, and a third of them are brain damaged. And I am standing before you. I mean, if that doesn't tell you... Oh, that doesn't tell you that, you know, miracles do happen. I mean, really. And I'm blessed because I have that knowledge that I should really be dead or incapacitated or disabled, and I'm not. That tells me that God has a purpose for me. So anyway, just fast forwarding through to what happened next. My dad and one of my brothers came down with the shirts on their back, and it was just a sad time. My mom and came down later on, and you know, they stayed with me for 6 weeks, and I think I was in the woods for like two of those 6 weeks, and it was a really, really terrible time. And I knew too that legally I was looking at a lot of time, and I had two previous DUIs, and this one being the third DUI manslaughter, I was looking at 15 years in prison. So anyway, and I didn't care. You know where I was? I did not care. I did not care. I didn't care about my physical pain. I didn't care about God. I was pissed. How could you do this to me? I've been a good person my whole life. How could you do this to me? You know? I didn't care about anything. I was an emotional wreck. Because of me, there's a life that's no longer on this planet. And how am I supposed to live with myself with that? So anyway, the turning point came when I was in the rehab center. You know, I was on the brain injury unit, the spinal cord injury unit, and, you know, I saw smiles and people that were, you know, quadriplegic, paraplegic, had traumatic brain injury. They were actually my spiritual awakening. You know, look at these people, look at them smiling. You know, and I'm sitting here feeling sorry for myself. You know, I mean, what's up with that? Then the volunteers that came in to just sit there and hold my hand, I started seeing spiritual awakenings and all that. When I got out of the hospital, I was in the hospital for the regular hospital for 3 months, no, 5 months, and then a rehab hospital outpatient for 6. And then I went to court, and I got sentenced to 5 years in prison and 10 years probation. And let me tell you, that was devastating, but I pled guilty. You know, there was no way I was getting up there and saying not guilty, because really that road should have been blocked off. But, you know, I'm like, no, I'm not going there. Something happened. I want to be able to sleep at night. Sentence me. Let me do my time. I know I'm going away. And I'll tell you something. 5 years in prison was not a cakewalk. But a lot of beautiful moments happened in prison, too. I met some of the best women in my life in there. And I saw the guy walking around with his prison uniform on, collecting money for corrections. Let me tell you, folks, whip out a buck and give that guy some money, because I lived for the meetings that people born into prison. I mean, what a service. I remember thinking, wow, this person, you know, doesn't think we're all pieces of crap. They're coming in here to share with us the message of AA. How cool is that? And you know what else? They look happy. They look joyous. They look free. They look normal. They look cool. You know, I mean, I couldn't believe it. So I lived for the AA meetings in prison, especially the ones that were brought in from people outside. I also lived for the priest to come and say Mass on Sundays. And I'm in the South. I'm in the Deep South. So they don't like Catholics too much down there. So we were allowed to have Mass once a month. And Father Dennis, who is also has 23 years of sobriety, he was the coolest priest. After Mass one Sunday, he just said, ladies, I just want to put something out to you. I'm also an alcoholic in recovery, and if anyone wants to do their fifth step with me, I'd love to do it with you. And I was like, man, that'll be cool. That'll be like killing two birds with one stone. Confession, fifth step. So, So I did it, and I'll tell you something. It was a huge turning point for me in prison. And I did. I also forgot about before I went to prison. My AA. That's when I first started going to AA in St. Pete Beach. Those people saved my life. I was only allowed to leave the house because I was under house arrest to go to AA meetings and physical therapy. And that group, my God, they welcomed me into their arms like a hurt child running to their mother. They told me, because those, as you can imagine, were the deepest, darkest hours of my life. They told me, honey, there but for the grace of God, that could have been me. And for some reason, that made me feel better, you know. Honey, I can't tell you. I drove in blackout drunks with three kids in my car. What happened to you could have happened to me so easily. And I was like, these people are so cool. You know, are they getting paid for this? And I mean, really, it was like all the kindnesses that were showed to me by AA. I'll be forever grateful to that group. And the whole time I was in prison, a whole contingent of them wrote to me. And I had a sponsor from the outside from that group in prison, so she walked me through the steps. And again, that's when I did my fifth step with Father Dennis. And it was a really pivotal moment. My other pivotal moment was Easter week, my second year in prison, and there was a young priest who looked just like Jesus. And I went to confession, and it was wild because I just said my regular confession. I repeated the same thing that I had been repeating every confession I went to with him. And when I looked up, he had tears coming down his eyes, and he looked pissed. And I was like, whoa. And he said, you know what, Jane? If I could, I would pick you up by your collar, throw you up against that wall, and slap you silly if I could. Because I am so sick and tired of you confessing the same sin over and over and over and over again. He's like, you don't get it. He's like, yeah, you screwed up. You confessed your sin to me about 6 months ago. I absolved you of your sin, threw it out there into the sea of forgiveness. It's gone. It's gone. It's holding you back right now, Jane. You've got to let that go. Who do you think you are to not accept God's forgiveness? You think you're above God's forgiveness? You call yourself a Christian and you're not accepting God's forgiveness? Don't come back to me anymore with that confession. And I was like, whoa! But again, that was a turning point for me because self-forgiveness, folks, is the hardest corner to turn. Self-forgiveness, if you can't get self-forgiveness down, I honestly don't think you can work a program. I don't think you can work your life. It'll hold you back. It'll keep you back. You've got to give it to God. You've got to give it to God. So, anyway, I'm going to sort of fast forward to the rebuilding part of my life right now, okay, what I'm like now. When I got out of prison after 5 years, I lost my license for life. I got lifetime revocation with no chance ever of a hardship license, which, hey, I'm alive. You know, I can get around. I can take the buses. I ride my bike. I'm pretty good shape for 48 years old because I ride my bike everywhere. And plus, my friends in AA love helping me out. For them, it's an opportunity to do service work for Jane. Let me take Jane to the grocery store. Let me take Jane down to school. It's like, oh, cool, I did some service work today. So, but it was really hard for me because I do have that stubborn Irish pride, and it was very hard initially for me to ask for help. Now, I don't have a problem with it at all. But because of this precious, life-sustaining gift of sobriety, I have begun a new life, a life that's better than I ever dreamed it could be. You know, God definitely promises us a safe landing, but he doesn't necessarily promise us a calm passage. And the rebuilding of my life has been a lot of work. When I got out of prison, I tried vehemently to get my teaching certification back to no avail, and I ended up in Tallahassee, Florida. I mean, I'm like, what the heck is in Tallahassee, Florida? Well, Florida State University's there. So when I said, well, if I can't get my teaching certification back, I think what I'll do is just go back to school and start a whole new career path and start a whole new life. So I figured when I was in prison, if I lived through this, I wanted to dedicate the rest of my life to love and service. And what better field to do that in than social work? So I applied to the master's program at FSU. I got denied 3 times because of my felony. 3 times, didn't give up. 4th time, my letter landed in the hands of the assistant dean, went for my interview, told her my whole story, never hid anything, never hid anything. Applications. What I would do when I was on interviews, I would just look at them and say, where would any of us be without forgiveness? Please give me a second chance. I promise you, I have a whole new life right now. And she was one of those first angels to give me a second chance. And not only did she allow me into Florida State University, but she told me that she was giving me an assistantship scholarship so I could work as her assistant 10 hours a week. So that was the first miracle. So then I went to grad school, and it wasn't easy, folks, because I couldn't get a job. I worked at the front desk of a hotel making $7 an hour with 3 degrees. It was quite humbling, but it was the best job I ever had. I loved that job. It was perfect to transition back into society, you know, being, because when you get out of prison after 5 years, you're a freak, okay? You really are. So I was smiling and, you know, kind of being myself and getting back, you know, finding my groove again. And then what I would do is I had to get up at 5 a.m. I had to walk a mile to the bus, take the bus, be at the front desk by 7. From 7 till 3, work at the front desk, and I had to hop a cab and by 4 be down at school, and I wouldn't get out of school till 9. And grad school's no joke. I'd do homework from 9 to 1 and get up the next day and do the same thing. And I did that for 2 years straight. Summer sessions, Christmas sessions, everything. I was in this mad rush to rebuild my life. So anyway, I graduated with my master's degrees, and I graduated at the top of my class. And I started doing internships on the psychiatric unit, working with the mentally ill who were in some sort of crisis, or people who had attempted to commit suicide, and detox. So every day I was working with addicts and alcoholics in detox, and I thought that was so cool. Guess what a part of my probation was that the judge gave me? For 10 years, I had to go to an AA meeting every day. Every day. And I for the first 5 years, it was every day. I finally went to the judge after 5 years, and she said, okay, 5 days a week. So anyway, I went to tons of AA meetings. The day I got out of prison, I went to an AA meeting, and that became my home group, and I love those people, and, you know, they'll always be my home group, and they promised me I would never be alone again, and I haven't been. I still go to a lot of meetings, but I don't go 5 days a week anymore. I just got off of probation this past December 30th. So, thank you. So, I love when newcomers come in and, you know, they're bitching, oh, man, how am I going to do this, man? I got a year probation. I don't drive. It's like, you're talking to the wrong person, okay? Because if you want to do it, you can do it, period. You know, you set your mind to it, you can do it. 10 years I had to do it. So anyway, you know, again, I feel like a big part of my story is that until the pain gets strong enough, nothing's going to change. And I never take for granted where I came from. Wait till you hear this. So, of course, my relationship with my family is better now than it's ever been. My brothers and sister are my best friends. My mom and dad are just, I mean, look at how adorable they are. They're the best, you know. And when I think of all the stuff I put them through, oh, you know, the fact that I'm back in their lives and I'm back to the Jane that they raised me to be is really a miracle. That's another miracle. It's another miracle. You know, I still deal with resentment. And again, I think it's because I'm Irish. I think, you know, resentment is the hardest thing for me to get rid of, you know. I stew over things, but I know what I need to do. It just sometimes I like to sit in that crap for a while, you know. But I wanted to share with you a prayer that I love and a prayer that's in my toolbox about resentments. And it was given to me by a nun named Sister B. And it's a prayer for the freedom of resentment. And we all know that great expectations lead to great disappointments. And we know that expectations are indeed premeditated resentments. But serenity comes when we stop expecting and start accepting. It's just the way it is, you know? So anyway, when I get resentful, this is the prayer that I say. God, help me to look with soft eyes upon all who are part of my days. Break through the barriers of my scrutinizing views. Transform my inner landscape into a peaceful place of acceptance. Pull back my projections and my criticisms. Replace my mean measurements and my biased expectations with an openness that allows others just to be. Cleanse me of everything that clouds my perceptions and blocks the sunlight of your spirit. So, resentments is one of the character defects that I have to work on a daily basis, like we all do. I mean, we all know what our spirituality entails, and it does entail a conscious contact with God on a daily basis. So I pray for the freedom of resentment daily. I want to tell you what's transpired again right now in my life. Again, my family. My sponsor always says talk about your marital status, your family, and your employment, because the big book tells you to do that. Well, marital status, none. Very, very happily unmarried, but I'm spoken for. I have a really fantastically wonderful boyfriend in my life right now, who is just awesome. So we'll see what happens. It's still sort of new, you know, expectations. Gonna stay away from resentments there, and just we've both made a point to put God first, and you know, just live day by day and enjoy each other day by day. Secondly, my family. I mean, I've got beautiful nieces and nephews that are like my kids, especially my sisters too. My relationship with mom and dad have never been better. Employment, wait till you hear this. Okay, so I worked in the psychiatric hospital for 5 years. They told me I would never teach again, at the high school level because I have a felony. So anyway, the assistant dean that I just spoke to you about, I had been working out in the field as a social worker for 5 years. Well, she called me. Coincidentally, this is wild. I was in Texas, in Houston, with my older brother Fred and my brother Joe. Joe flew out to be supportive of my brother Fred and his wife Barbara because their son was going through things and was in a rehab at 14. So we all just wanted to gather around, and of course, you know, I wanted to tell Fred about recovery, and my brother Joe was there too. And we're sitting at Fred and Barbara's kitchen table, and a phone call came in, and it was the dean and the assistant dean, and they said, Jane, would you be interested in a full-time faculty position at Florida State? I was like, what? What? Oh my God! And my brothers were like, oh, yeah, that's cool, Jane. My brother Joe said, let me tell you something, Jane. You got balls. So I've been working at Florida State in the College of Social Work. I teach all classes that I love. The year before last, my first year of teaching at the spring convocation, the students voted me Professor of the Year, so I got a special award for that. And And believe me, it's very hard for me to do this because I feel like I'm tooting my own horn, but I feel like it's really important for newcomers to be like, look what can happen. 10 years ago, I was sitting on a prison bunk. Now, I'm professor of the year at Florida State University. You know, so, I mean, it's just crazy what God has done in my life and what God can do in your life, too. Today, truly, happiness for me is not getting what I want, but wanting what I get. I keep it really, really simple. As I live my life today, if I stumble, which I do, I know that the answer is only 12 steps away. I know the answer's in that big book. I know for all of you who are new, I need to tell you this. It is never too late to become the person that you were meant to be. Never too late. You know, how cool is it that we now have the chance to live the life that we never had a chance to live before? I've done so many cool things. But anyway, I know that we're running out of time, so I wanted to close with one of my favorite lines from the big book, the Keys to the Kingdom one, page 276, if anyone wants to join me. Where is it? Okay. And I'm going to personalize it a little. The last 14 years of my life have been very rich and meaningful. I have had my share of problems, heartaches, and disappointments, because that is life. But I have known a great deal of joy and a peace that is the handmaiden of an inner freedom. I have a wealth of friends and, with my AA friends, an unusual quality of fellowship. For to these people, I am truly related, first through mutual pain and despair, and later through mutual objectives and newfound faith and hope. And as the years go by, working together, sharing our experiences with one another, and also sharing a mutual trust, understanding, and love without strings, without obligation, we acquire relationships that are unique and priceless. There is no more aloneness with that awful ache so deep in the heart of every alcoholic that nothing before could ever reach it. That ache is gone and never need return again. Now, there is a sense of belonging, of being wanted, and needed, and loved. In return for a bottle and a hangover, we have been given the keys to the kingdom. I love that. So, I have chosen to take the high road to a new freedom. My life is just wonderful. I know when I go through my day and I get agitated, I pause and I pray. Always, I have to remember, and I hope that all of you remember this, your higher power is far greater than any fear that God ever puts before you or that life ever puts before you. You can get through it. If we follow the principles, we replace that crazy desperation with hope. We replace despair with faith, fear with courage, confusion with peace of mind, self-contempt with self-respect, helplessness with self-confidence, guilt with a clean conscience. I like that one. Boy, living this program is so stress-free, isn't it? And loneliness with real relationships. I don't know how this is going to go, but I kind of got inspired at karaoke last night. So I just want to sing this verse to my mom. Somewhere over the rainbow, skies are blue, and the dreams dreams that you dare to dream really do come true. Please don't ever give up on your dreams. Don't ever limit your dreams. Thank you so much.